Welcome to Life and Sirens, Behind and On the Scene, a podcast by first responders. We're your hosts, Sophie,
Jamie,
and Aubrey.
The content provided in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any medical institutions, emergency medical services, or healthcare organizations. Patient privacy is a top priority, and all discussions involving real-world emergency situations are de-identified and altered to ensure confidentiality. Always consult with a qualified healthcare professional or your local EMS protocols before making any decisions regarding patient care or medical practices. Listener discretion is advised, as some topics may include discussions of real-world emergency situations.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Life and Sirens. I'm Sophie, and today I don't have Jamie and Aubrey with me, and that makes me very sad, but let me tell you, it is quite a task to get three paramedics in the same room at the same time to record a podcast, especially if you know anything about us. We are quite chaotic and doing about 100 million things a week, so unfortunately, they will not be joining me today, but we still wanted to get an episode in, so thanks for tuning in, and today we're going to talk about bradycardia, and not just in the slow heart rate sense, but in the what is this rhythm actually telling me sense. This is one of those rhythms that can lull you into a false sense of security. You look at the monitor, see the rate at 48, and your brain says, they're probably just beta blocked, or on a rate controller, whatever it is. Or they're a healthy young person, and their heart rate's always 48, so there can be a lot of ways that bradycardia is totally okay. But that slow rate could also be a warning sign of something bigger, like a failing electrical system or a toxic overdose. So today, we'll talk through the bradycardias and what it is and what it isn't. We'll explore common causes, the dangers of giving atropine in the wrong setting, which is absolutely a hill I'll die on. We'll talk about toxicology, and overdoses and how that can cause bradycardia. And we'll even hit on pediatric bradycardia, which is honestly an entirely different beast, but nonetheless, we will be discussing it. And to tie it all together, we'll walk through a real life EMS case that forced me to slow down and rethink everything I'd been taught about slow heart rates. Let me tell you guys, I went through a period after I got out of paramedic school, and honestly still, I feel like I get way more bradycardic patients than anybody that I know. I think we all have our flavor of that like one call that we get all the time, and bradycardia just happens to be that one call that I get all the time. All right, so let's start with the basics. Bradycardia is defined as a heart rate less than 60 beats per minute in an adult. But let's be honest, how often do we see a heart rate of 58? Probably every shift. So just because the monitor says a number doesn't mean we need to be panicking yet. Physiologic bradycardia is common, especially in athletes and people who have beta blockers or rate controllers on board, or anybody with like super high parasympathetic tone. So not all slow rates are emergencies, like we said. The problem comes when bradycardia is symptomatic, and by that I mean like altered mental status, hypotension, chest pain, syncope, or signs of poor perfusion like cool extremities, modeling, or low cap refill. So use your noggins, you guys are smart, make sure that we're really assessing these patients and looking for those signs and symptoms of shock. So when we see these signs and symptoms, that's when your differential better shift into high gear. And here's where things get tricky. Rhythm matters. So it's more than just sinus bradycardia or bradycardia. It's when we move into those junctional rhythms, less common but important to learn about, because that's when things get really scary. And then your other heart blocks, like first degree, that one's usually stable. We don't need to freak out too much about first degree, but it's something to note. Morbitz 1 and 2, so Morbitz 1 is Winckelbach, so that's often vagal or a transient block. And then once we get up to Morbitz 2, that is a big red flag. Then third degree or complete blocks, which is complete dissociation between the atria and ventricles. That is a very, very scary place to be, and you should absolutely consider that a peri-arrest state. Most patients are going to be critically ill if we make it to a third degree block. All right, so let's talk about a real call. I was on a 24 when we were dispatched to a rural home for lethargy. It was a middle-aged man, late 50s, recently discharged from the hospital. His wife said that he hadn't really been acting right all morning. So we walk in, and he's just kind of, you can tell, he's exhausted. He's pale, he's mildly diaphoretic, and his GCS is 11, which, that is a red flag for a normal person, right? So we start getting vitals. His blood pressure was 72 over 44, and his heart rate, 34. So we throw him on the monitor. He's in a wide complex bradycardia. There are P waves, and they're not playing with the QRSs. So they are not correlating with these QRSs at all. So I'm staring at a third degree block thinking, wonderful. We are in the middle of the county, about 40 minutes from the hospital. So this should be fun. So my EMT partner, she starts an IV and grabs the pads, which is a great move. This patient definitely needs to be on the pads. I gave 1 milligram of atropine because, well, that is the protocol, right? But nothing happens. That rate did not budge. In fact, his heart got even sleepier. I try another dose, still no response. At this point, I grab my monitor and I make sure we're ready to pace because this is not looking good. So we start pacing at a rate of 80, and we got capture around 110 milliamps, if I remember correctly, maybe 100 milliamps. Then, you know, his pressure starts climbing back, he perks up, and we need to give him some pain medication because now he is alert and oriented and very aware of the situation. When we get to the ED, there's actually a cardiologist downstairs, and confirmed it. We were in a complete heart block, just like we thought. Likely secondary to scar tissue after reading back on the AV node from a previous MI. So he did get a pacemaker, but that just reminds you, when we are working with those high degree blocks, there's a good chance that those atropine doses are not going to work and could even become detrimental. So when you see those wide complex bradycardias with those PQRS disassociations, atropine's going to probably do nothing or make it worse. It's just going to delay your definitive intervention, which is more than likely pacing or pressors or both. So let's talk about atropine. If Jamie and Aubrey here, they'd be cracking up because they know, like, casually that atropine is my, like, arch nemesis. I'm just not a big fan because I've been into some scary situations because we gave atropine because that's the protocol. But really, it can get sketchy when you're giving atropine in these high degree blocks. Anyway, I digress. Let's talk about atropine. So 1 milligram IV push every 3 to 5 minutes with a max dose of 3 milligrams. So it's your go-to first line for unstable bradycardia, but only if the conduction issue is vagal or nodal. So here's the kicker. Atropine doesn't work and might worsen infranodal blocks like Morbitz 2 or third degree blocks with a wide QRS. So why does it do that? Let me tell you. Because atropine works by inhibiting vagal input at the AV node. And if the block is below that, say in the bundle branches, you're basically yelling down a hallway that's already collapsed. So the message is not going to get to where it needs to go to increase the heart rate. Studies show that atropine can actually cause paradoxical slowing in some cases. That's why the AHA recommends skipping straight to pacing or epi, or even dopamine, they say, when it's a high degree AV block. So just keep that in mind. Atropine is not the fix-all. It's not a medication that we suggest, say, give and see what happens. I think we hear that a lot. At least I did when I was in school. Just give the atropine and see what happens while you're working on all the other stuff, while you're getting the, you know, the pacing pads on, while you're doing all this stuff. No, don't do that. We need to make sure we know why this patient's bradycardic and what, if they're in a block, what block is it? So caution with high degree blocks. I mean that from the very bottom of my heart. All right, now let's talk about where it gets weird, because bradycardia isn't always a conduction system failure. Sometimes it's about toxins. So some of the heavy hitters and the most common ones you're going to see are clonidine overdoses, especially in peds. Tiny amounts, I mean literally like half a tablet, can cause profound bradycardia and hypotension in these little nuggets. So big red flag. Not super common, but more common than you think. Beta blockers or calcium channel blockers. So these blunt the SA and AV nodes. So look for hypoglycemia and altered mental status in these patients. And remember that atropine probably isn't going to work in those patients who experience beta blocker overdoses. And then organophosphates. So cholinergic overload. Think sludge, salivation, lacrimation, vomiting, diarrhea, bradycardia. It's going to be quite a fiasco if you encounter a patient with organophosphate poisoning. So you'll need quite a bit of atropine for those situations. All right. By the way, let's just talk about this now. A slow heart rate in the context of toxidromes isn't just a number. It's a warning. So something is hijacking their physiology. And obviously, like we talked about, the bradycardia isn't just a conduction system failure. If we have a toxidrome situation and we're already bradycardic, the clock is ticking. So let's make sure we can attempt to identify the toxidrome and reverse it or treat that toxin. All right, moving on to our pediatric bradycardia. In kids, bradycardia is almost always one thing. What is that one thing, guys? Yep, hypoxia. Hypoxia in the pediatric patient or respiratory failure, those are the things that are going to cause, most commonly going to cause bradycardia in pediatric patients. So if you've got a kiddo with a heart rate below 60 and signs of poor perfusion, that's when you start CPR. And that's PALS 101. So your first step, obviously, open the airway. Make sure we have appropriate ventilation and oxygenation. We need to get IV or IO access. And then that's when we start moving on to things after we've addressed the airway and that hasn't improved. That's when we move on to epinephrine. We kind of skip atropine in most scenarios with pediatric patients. So what is the epidose in peds patients? I'll give you 3, 2, 1. Epidose in pediatric patients is 0.01 megs per keg. So like I said, atropine is rarely used in these peds patients. You might give it for bradycardia, but typically it's going to be in the setting of like pre-intubation or some kind of weird high vagal tone, which is not going to be on your radar or something you're going to be discussing in an ambulance. But in most cases, oxygenation and then epinephrine. And here's a little bonus for you. If you're seeing bradycardia in a previously healthy child, no medical problems, no cardiac problems, no congenital issues, probably think ingestion. So think clonidine, opioids, grandma's cardiac meds, and even medications. Sorry, not medications, I should say. Even drugs like THC, profound ingestion can cause some bradycardia. Kids get into everything, so definitely not something we want to rule out immediately in those kids. All right, let's tie this all together. And like I said, this is a short episode, so we're getting to the point. Let's wrap it up. So in adults, bradycardia is all about context. Stable or unstable, narrow or wide, sinus or block. We need to make sure we're making a very critical decision with all the information we could possibly have. So don't just throw atropine at it. Don't waste your time with that, especially in patients with third degree or Morbitz type 2 wide complexes. Go straight to pacing and or pressors. You may need both. It's totally possible. When we're pacing, make sure we're not just getting electrical capture, but also mechanical capture, and we have improvement in our blood pressure as well. In toxicology, dig deep, because that slow rate may be from a medication you didn't even know they took. It could be a medication that their parents have or grandma has. So ask all the questions. If you encounter a pediatric patient with a slow heart rate, make sure it may be our partner, we can send them, or a firefighter in to make sure we are asking all the right questions to determine if this patient is experiencing an ingestion-related bradycardia. And in those peds, remember, we are going to make sure we ventilate and oxygenate first and compress if needed, but give the epi early. Again, another situation where we skip the atropine. PALS 101 for you. And in all cases, trust the story more than the strip. Know why the patient is bradycardic. Know whether the patient is bradycardic emergently or if this is something that they chronically live with. Maybe they are on rate controllers, they're beta blocked, or they are just a healthy young person. So don't panic always when you see a patient who is experiencing bradycardia. Look at the big picture and make sure you trust your gut and do what's best for that patient and their specific situation. So let's dig into some trivia. True or false? A heart rate of 50 beats per minute always requires treatment in adults. I know you guys know this one. Easy peasy. False. Many adults, especially athletes, have physiologic bradycardia without symptoms. So easy peasy one. We're starting off soft here. All right, number two. What is the first line drug for symptomatic bradycardia in adults? I feel like based on what I've been babbling about today, this is a trick question. But the answer is atropine. Atropine is still first line for bradycardia in adults. How many milligrams of atropine can be given total per ACLS guidelines? The answer to that is 3 milligrams. So you can give 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes. Again, up to 3 milligrams. And if we're getting up to 3 milligrams, we definitely need to be working on probably some pressors or some electrical interventions. All right, more trivia for you. Heart blocks and rhythms. So number four, which is more dangerous, Morbitz 1 or Morbitz 2? This is also easy peasy, guys. Come on. It's in the name. It just escalates. Morbitz 2 is more dangerous because it is unpredictable and it can pretty quickly progress to a third degree block. So that guy is a little sinister. Number five, in third degree heart blocks, which part of the heart takes over as the pacemaker? 3, 2, 1. Ventricular. So often with wide QRSs and slow rates, we'll have a ventricular pacemaker. All right, number six. True or false? Atropine is always effective. No. As you know, this is my soapbox. In higher degree blocks, typically atropine is not effective. All right, let's move on to our toxicology questions. Which overdose is most likely to cause bradycardia and pinpoint pupils? Opioid. You guys know this one. And usually that's because we've already become tachycardic and we've been hypoxemic for so long that we are now becoming bradycardic. All right. Clonidine overdoses is most dangerous in which age group? Pediatric patients. You guys know that just makes sense, right? Pediatric patients. It's not like all the time, but it is one of those more common overdoses. So keep it on your radar. All right, number 10. In pediatric patients, what's the most common cause of bradycardia? I know you guys know this one, so I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Hypoxemia, respiratory failure typically. Number 11. At what heart rate do you begin chest compressions in a child with poor perfusion? Like, very sick child, okay? A little sick bebé. Below 60 beats per minute. Thank you, pals. All right, last but not least, number 12. What is the pediatric dose for epinephrine for bradycardia? That's right, 0.01 megs per kg, IV or IO, and that is epi 1 to 10,000. Thank you guys for hearing me ramble on about bradycardia, especially my love-hate relationship with atropine. I have plenty more stories to tell you the horrors of atropine because, man, that stresses me out. So just be careful with that one, okay? I'm not trying to scare you, but it is scary. So, again, thanks for hanging out with me today. If this episode helped you break down bradycardia just a little more clearly, share it with your partner, share it with your students, or the next medic who joins the service. We want all your pals to know about Life and Sirens. And just remember, because it's slow doesn't mean you should be panicking. Like we've talked about, consider the whole story, what your patient looks like, and what could have caused this bradycardia. Until next time, this is Sophie from Life and Sirens. Slow and steady wins the race. Don't be the chaos. Don't be the chaos. And don't panic if your patient's bradycardic. See you later. Got a blast. Bye.
This has been Life and Sirens, produced by three nerds trying to bring you content that you might actually care about.